All right, the time being 8:15, the House Human Services Policy and Finance Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. And Representative Jacob, being the first member here this morning, had plenty of time to review the minutes and moves the minutes for approval from April 7th, 2026. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes from April 7th, 2026 are adopted. Members, today we have one item on the agenda. It's a report from the Office of Legislative Auditor. And so welcome to the committee. Please present, give us your presentation, and start with an introduction of your names for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Catherine Tyson, and I'm a Deputy Legislative Auditor from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I oversee our Special Reviews Division, and I'm here today to talk about a recently released special review. With me at the table to assist with any questions is OLA's General Counsel, Nathan Shepherd. So as I said, I'm going to be speaking today about a special review that concerned the Department of Human Services investigations of alleged kickbacks in the Early Intensive Developmental and Behavioral Intervention Program. That program is also known as the EIDBI program. In early 2024, we received a credible complaint from an individual who believed that the Department of Human Services Office of Inspector General had not been appropriately handling complaints it received regarding EIDBI providers. In response to this complaint, we reviewed the reasons why DHS OIG closed complaints about EIDBI providers without further investigation. We also looked at whether OIG staff took reasonable steps when determining whether to investigate allegations of fraud, theft, abuse, and error in the EIDBI program. As I'm sure many are aware, but for anyone who might be listening and unfamiliar with the EIDBI program, the Department of Human Services oversees the administration of the EIDBI benefit. The legislature enacted this benefit in 2013, and last year you all made some changes to move towards licensure for these providers. The purpose of the EIDBI benefit is to provide early intervention for children and youth under 21 years of age who are enrolled in the state's medical assistance or MA program and who have autism spectrum disorder or related conditions. Specifically, the benefit is intended to reimburse participating providers for various evidence-based treatment modalities to help kids and youth develop and maintain skills. In 2024, approximately 5,600 individuals received EIDBI services. We concluded through this review that most of the decisions we reviewed, the decisions of OIG that we reviewed, were reasonable given the information OIG collected or analyzed in response to complaints it received. However, when we inquired about three complaints that involved only allegations of kickbacks, so allegations of kickbacks not containing other allegations or indications of fraud, theft, abuse, or error, DHS officials asserted that prior to 2025, the department did not have the authority to investigate allegations of kickbacks in the EIDBI program if it was only involving allegations of kickbacks. But we disagreed that DHS didn't have the ability to act upon allegations of kickbacks. Instead, we identified several ways DHS could have used existing authority to address allegations of kickbacks. We also identified a potential limit to DHS's current authority to withhold or reduce payments on the basis of credible allegations of kickbacks alone. I'm going to get into those details in just a bit, but I do want to just emphasize or describe what a kickback is and emphasize the importance of this discussion. In the context of public health care programs, a kickback is money or something of value that is given to an individual or organization to induce that individual or organization to generate business for a health care provider. Kickbacks in public health care programs can lead to overuse of health care services as well as increased program costs, among other things. Kickbacks have long been prohibited under federal law for federal health care programs, but they were not illegal under state law until the 2025 legislature passed a law criminalizing kickbacks in state public health care programs. The 2025 legislature also adopted legislation that added explicit authority for DHS to sanction MA providers that solicit, receive, pay, or offer to pay kickbacks in the MA program. However, as I have just said, we found that Minnesota law has long authorized DHS to impose sanctions for kickbacks, and it does so by citing specific federal Social Security Act provisions. Specifically, since 1997, state law has permitted DHS to impose sanctions for any reason for which an individual or entity could be excluded from participation in the Medicare program under specified sections of the Social Security Act. One of the reasons is engaging in acts described in the federal anti-kickback statute. So, because engaging in conduct that violated the federal anti-kickback statute was a permissible basis for exclusion under the Social Security Act, it was also a permissible basis under state law for DHS to impose sanctions on MA providers. Even if DHS had disagreed with this legal interpretation, we also note that it could have acted independently to remedy its perceived lack of authority to address kickbacks. Specifically, DHS could have done so by correcting an error made in its rules, and this error is within the rule definition of fraud. This matters because DHS relies on this rule definition of fraud when acting on allegations of provider misconduct. The error is an incorrect citation to federal law. The rule specifically cites a federal statute that contains exceptions to the felonies described in the federal anti-kickback statute. DHS cited this incorrect federal statute when it amended the rule in 1995, and it has remained the same ever since, despite the department making changes to other parts of this rule. We believe had DHS corrected the rule at any time since 1995, it would have had another avenue of clear authority to sanction providers who engage in kickbacks. Before I move to the next slide, I just want to pause and kind of check in where we're at, because this is a very complicated and technical topic. What we have been talking about is DHS's authority to sanction providers. Usually this is happening at the conclusion of an investigation. Sanctions include things like termination of providers' participation in MA, or fines, for example. While we believe DHS could have taken those actions for these specific types of allegations prior to last year, I will note again that the 2025 legislature made changes to the statute to give DHS explicit and specific authority to sanction providers for offering, receiving, or paying kickbacks. So that was we believe that was a belt and suspenders type of amendment, but there is one remaining issue, and I'm going to be moving to that now. This remaining issue relates to DHS's authority during an investigation. Until fraud is defined in administrative rule or applicable state law to include kickbacks, it is unclear to us whether DHS has legal authority to suspend payments to MA providers while investigating credible allegations of kickbacks alone. Again, I want to emphasize this last portion. This relates to kickback allegations alone and not to other conduct that relates to fraud, theft, abuse, or error. DHS is authorized to impose sanctions on providers for any of several reasons identified in state statute, but it may not do so without prior notice and opportunity for hearing. However, DHS may withhold or reduce payments without prior notice and hearing if it determines that there is a credible allegation of fraud for which an investigation is pending under the program. The statute identifies the circumstances that would cause an allegation to be credible, and DHS relies on the definition of fraud in its administrative rules to determine whether action constitutes fraud. So, because DHS has incorporated a faulty citation in its administrative rule, it is unclear that they have authority to withhold or reduce payments to providers on the basis of kickbacks alone without prior notice and hearing. In the report, we make a recommendation. We recommend that DHS amend its administrative rule to clearly define fraud, to clearly include kickbacks. We also say that if DHS is not initiate a rulemaking process, to correct this issue, the legislature could and should take action to resolve the issue. I will note that several members of this committee have introduced legislation that take a variety of approaches to address this issue. This is the end of my presentation, so I would be happy to take questions.
Deputy Tyson, thank you for your presentation this morning and for your work at the Office of Legislative Auditor on our behalf. While we're collecting names for questions, I'll just start with one. This was prompted because of credible complaints that come to your office. How often does that happen, that this is the process where you start an investigation like this?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for that question. I always like to talk about the work of my division. So we receive hundreds of allegations per year. Specifically, last year we received over 760 allegations of wrongdoing in state government. We have a small staff, so we must make really challenging and difficult decisions every day. We do complete about 4 special reviews per year, but we are also actively conducting smaller inquiries throughout the year to assess the credibility and the potential impact of allegations of wrongdoing.
Thank you for that. In the report, you talk about how the rule itself was put in place in 1995. And so I don't know if you've had this issue come up in other parts of government, but when I did the research, we've had 5 different administrations during that time that could have gone back and made corrections to this on the uniquely tripartisan level to make these fixes. Is that something, are these types of rules and definitions reviewed on a regular basis or at all in this, or have you seen this in other parts of state government as well?
Mr. Chair, members, I am not aware of this, a similar issue occurring in recent OLA audits. I have been with OLA for a little more than a decade. However, I will say that state agencies are required by state law to regularly review their rules and recommend to the legislature that the legislature repeal outdated rules, for example. Agencies are constantly, it's an assumption, using their rules to effectuate the policy. So it was unclear to us whether DHS, had identified the error prior to OLA bringing it to DHS's attention. But it is something that, agencies should be aware of is their rules and whether there are errors and how they are working.
Thank you, Ms. Deputy Tyson, for that. And just one follow-up to that then, is the decision process for that, is that more on the civil servant level or on the political level for that, in the definition or the understanding of things, the drafting of the rules, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members, I think it would be challenging for me to answer that question on a broad scale, but for DHS specifically, I'd encourage you to ask that same question of DHS.
Very good. Thank you, Deputy Tyson. Representative Backer.
Yeah. Thank you, and I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but have you heard from other sources or from the work you did with EIDVI, have you seen other patterns in other part of DHS that would follow this type of scenario?
Deputy Tyson.
Unfortunately, I'm not able to speak about either the existence or status, I guess, of ongoing OLA evaluations of complaints. I will say, though, that at least in recent memory, I don't believe OLA has published reports that relate to this topic.
Okay. Representative Backer.
Thank you. And so from the 700 or so complaints that you received, obviously not all of them focused on this. Have you seen any patterns that we should be aware of, gaps? Then would be my next question, my final question.
Mm-hmm. Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Backer, I will follow up with you. We are soon going to be releasing an annual report of our work, and there may be some actions that we can speak about after.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you so much for the overview. I think we're finding a lot of areas where we can certainly have a little more oversight and partnership with DHS to ensure we're keeping language up, and I appreciate that. I'm curious, throughout the investigation process, I know we've talked a lot about in this committee how uncomfortable it is for whistleblowers to report information. To your knowledge, in regards to this report and investigation specifically, are you aware of any whistleblower retaliation or anything like that that happened?
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I am not aware.
Representative Curran.
No, thank you for that. And I'm not sure if that's something that your office might be able to disclose, I suppose. If not, I would hope that we could find an avenue to do so, so that the legislature might be able to do whatever we need to do to strengthen employee protections and whistleblower protections.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I do want to follow up with just stating OLA's authorities for protecting whistleblowers. We have unique authority in 3.979, Municipal Statutes 3.979, to protect the identity of individuals who would not otherwise share such information with OLA. I would also note that disclosures or reports to OLA are covered by the whistleblower protections that are more broadly applicable here too.
Representative Curran.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And just along those lines too, I know these investigations are difficult, but when you approached DHS OIG to work on this and investigate, did you find that there were any concerns in conducting your investigation? Did you have any barriers? Or did you find that there was a willingness to engage? Can you kind of tell us how that went?
Deputy Tyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Curran. DHS staff cooperated fully with this review, and we received full cooperation.
Representative Curran.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along the way, you mentioned you had about 700 or so complaints in the last year, four large special investigations and some smaller ones. I think it kind of left an unanswered question for all of us, and you had to kind of triage the complaints you got to decide which ones deserved that deeper dive. How many would you say were left uninvestigated completely? And what can we do to equip you to do that? If you think that you should dip a little lower into that pool of complaints that come in, what can we do as a legislature to equip you to do it? So how many would be left uninvestigated, and what would be needed? Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, excuse me, I have a frog in my throat. I will have to follow up with you about the exact percentage. I would say that we may take several different types of actions to ensure that complaints are handled appropriately. And one of the really common actions that we take is referring complaints to the or other bodies within the state government or even federal government that have boots on the ground investigators. For example, we very frequently refer allegations that our office receives regarding fraud, waste, abuse concerns of MA providers. We very frequently refer those to the DHS Office of Inspector General and to the AG's MUFUKU. So I'll have to follow up about that specific percentage from last year. I know you all make very difficult decisions about the state's resources. You know, clearly, if we had additional resources, we would likely be able to dip lower into that bucket. But that will probably be a conversation for future.
Thank you.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last question, and maybe this is outside of your purview, but when we go back into our district and we think of fraud, waste, abuse, in this case, kickbacks, which turns out to be fraud, waste, and abuse, are you in any way aware of how are we recovering funds? Is that within your purview? Are we able to recover those funds for our taxpayers and maybe for program participants who really need them? Thank you.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and representatives, that is outside of our purview, but I will say that there are processes established to recoup funds.
Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Deputy Tyson, for this presentation. So curious, like, so does it throw red flags to see the drastic increase in EIDBI enrollment in that 2020 to 2024 when we saw the huge boom? Was that something that also was reported at that time?
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think generally, you know, increases in participation of programs might be a red flag. There's, you know, potential other confounding factors. Perhaps there's additional providers available to provide services in meeting an unmet need. I'm unable to kind of speak on the exact root cause of that growth at this moment, but I will say that it could be a red flag in certain circumstances.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And a follow-up around this is just we keep talking about our IT systems and how we communicate across the board with different providers, programs from counties, you know, administering and just the tedious, laborious work of our archaic system. Do you believe that that will catch more errors or more potential waste, fraud, and abuse when we have an updated system? Do you think that that would be something that would be of high value for Minnesota to invest into that infrastructure?
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, I think, you know, speaking generally, again, IT systems that, you know, have evolved or are evolving or are amended to evolve, basically, to meet current needs, I think that that is an important piece. I mean, fraud schemes themselves are constantly evolving, and in order to kind of keep up with different schemes and the methods and the nature of them, having up-to-date systems that talk with each other efficiently without error generally is a benefit.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, and thank you for that response. So a follow-up around that. As an OLA department, I'm not sure if every state has an OLA department or not. And if so, do you go to conferences where you learn what other states are doing or things that are working well, not only from the federal level, but from the state level that we could incorporate? There's so many systems that are available, what we're learning, that we could be a part of a system and that would help shore things up. But I'm curious if you know, do your continuing ed, you've been doing this, you said, for over a decade or around a decade. So I'm just curious about that piece.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, yes, there are professional organizations that we frequently attend conferences from those organizations. Very many states have offices that are similar to OLA in their independence and nonpartisanship. Sometimes they're called state auditors. Sometimes they're called legislative auditors. But yes, we are definitely, as staff and as leaders, we're ingrained in those professional organizations and in those same conversations.
Wonderful.
Conference of Auditors sounds like a hoot and good time. Representative Gilman.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That's really good. So besides giving us reports, you know, would that be something that you could come back to the legislature and tell us, like, hey, here's what we've learned. This is something that we think would be very helpful, you know, prior to us coming into session, or, you know, a way that we could follow up and know what we could do so we could be prepared to support, again, protecting tax dollars, protecting, you know, folks that are most vulnerable, but, you know, also just going after, I mean, every week, everybody here is hearing about fraud and hearing about the schemes that people are using to, pillage our resources. So I just wonder if you ever come back and bring those things besides just the reports to us, because I think it's powerful.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, short answer, yes. We are required each year to produce a report following up on past recommendations as resources allow. And I don't have it in front of me, so I can't talk about specifics right at the moment. But it is something that we do regularly as follow-up on past recommendations that our office has made, as well as agencies' actions in resolving those recommendations.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you for this. And again, I just want to thank this group of folks, too, that put into Representative Hicks with provisional licensure around this. I'll be so curious to see what the number is right now of the providers that, if it's still under 10, that have done their provisional licensure for being a provider, or out of the 550 providers that. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where we're at with that. Just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jacob.
Oh, thank you, Chair Schumacher and Deputy Tyson. So, kind of at the crux of the issue, disagreement between DHS and really OLA about whether DHS had the authority to pursue kickbacks. So I think my specific question would be, regardless of any of that, could DHS have pursued an amendment to resolve this kickback issue definition without legislative action? Is that something they could have done if they wanted to? To resolve the issue?
Deputy Tyson.
Chair Schumacher and Representative Jacob, yes, that's a short answer. As we stated in the report, had DHS disagreed with our interpretation that they had statutory authority to pursue investigations and sanctions of allegations of kickbacks, they could have acted independently to remedy an error that is in the administrative rules, giving them another avenue to sanction providers for engaging in kickbacks.
Representative Jacob.
And from what we know, they just chose not to.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob. When we asked those same questions of the department, the folks who were are in those positions now, they were not in the positions that they are in currently. Back when this error was made, it was made about 30 years ago, but it wasn't clear to us that DHS had identified the error in rule prior to when we began inquiring about it during the course of this special review.
Representative Jacob.
That's all. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Deputy Tyson. My question is really a little bit off of Representative Gilman's. And I was just looking at the trends. You know, we saw the trends of rapidly increasing enrollment in 20 to 2024. I just wonder if you could give us a picture of what the trends look like in 2025, and not so much for kickbacks yet, but just for enrollment, and then 2026.
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not have that data now. We analyzed the data that DHS was able to provide to us for the years that are within the report. So I think DHS would be able to speak more on the trends since the end of the data that we've presented in the report.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to that, then how would you look at it if you did see a sharp difference or reduction in the enrollments, like some of the numbers we're seeing? Representative Gilman commented 10, maybe out of about 500 have reapplied. How do you look into those trends? Do they add up for you in any way, like the ramping up or now the ramping down of the program in terms of enrollment? What do you look at from your perspective?
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think that any trend like that would further emphasize the importance of oversight and monitoring of program participants. So in this case, we're talking about providers. You know, there are certain processes that are established by state or federal law for reviewing on a regular basis MA providers, and you know, those processes in part are there to ensure that services are appropriate and they are appropriately given to people who need them. But those monitoring processes are also there to ensure the validity of providers who are providing critical health care programs.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my hope is that your scope would look a little different, and maybe even look back at the people that didn't apply, because it is interesting that so many would ramp up and so many would ramp down. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there's a window there, too. If we're looking to try to find offenders, they might be in that group. And so I hope you would look at people that were in the program that didn't reapply, mm-hmm, as a potential for what we're looking into for fraud. Thank you.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. My question actually isn't related to what any of the other questions were. I'm sort of interested in, like, our role as the legislature and what we do here. And so I'm looking at page 13 of the report, and it talks about there was some things that happened in 94 and 95. I wasn't here. But it says that DHS intended to include different things. And so I know we talk a lot about, when you guys go back and look at the legislative record, did you look at, like, the committee hearings and hear what DHS said on the record for their intent? Or is it all just asking them now what they intended back then? Because, mm-hmm, I think it's also important for us as legislators to know what kind of questions we should ask on the record and how in, you know, years later, when we look back at decisions that were made around statutes, giving oversight to agencies, how can we make sure we're on the record with the correct intent as well?
Deputy Tyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keeler, I have a multi-part response, so I might need to ask you to repeat certain things. But I think just to clarify, on page 13, we're speaking about a rulemaking process that DHS undertook in 1994 to 1995. And so specifically, documents from that rulemaking process indicate that it had intended to include in the definition of fraud in its rule a list of specified state and federal statutes describing conduct that would constitute fraud, including kickbacks. As far as the record that we reviewed, the rulemaking record that we reviewed, it does not look like the error was identified during the rulemaking process. I also want to move to your more general record or question about I think, if I'm interpreting right, how the Office of the Legislative Auditor might review legal history. And short answer is when there are questions about interpretation specifically, or when we internally are ensuring that we are applying the correct standards, we very frequently review committee hearings. Thanks to our wonderful counsel, we dig into case law and look at kind of the apple or the you know the entire body of law that might be related to the issue that we were digging into. And I believe there was a third part of my answer, but I do want to see if I did fully answer your question first.
No, that was really helpful. Okay. I think too, it's just this rulemaking ability that keeps happening that seems like it's kind of done behind closed doors. I don't think that that's always this public process that we all get to see and have a part of when the agency gets to decide what's intended or not behind, like during the interim when we're not here making decisions. And so I think this is just an ongoing narrative that we have to work better together, and we can't make statutes and then have our agencies making these sort of rulemaking behind our back in a non-public way. We'll talk more offline because I do have some more questions about it, but we can connect after this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. This is more of a comment. I want to be really clear because and just get on the record because nobody is has stronger feelings about EIDBI licensing than I do, as I think you all remember from last year. So I need everybody to just remember that applications didn't open until January, and they don't need to be done until July. So let's not find a villain in a story that is simply, it's a process, right? Then those timelines were set by the people in this room around this table. So if you didn't like that timeline, the time to say that would have been last year. So we could have picked a different timeline. So we will get to licensing. This team, collective team, worked really hard to put that in place, but we picked the timeline. So if we don't like it, that was sort of our fault.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Knorr, Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Deputy. Just wanted to ask, get some clarifying things. I know we got to do some work here. So the section that I wanted to clarify is the illegal remuneration. You got it right? That we took care of the anti-kickback statutes, that 609.542. Is that sufficient enough to address the penalties that are required for any kickback?
Deputy Tyson.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, the change to which you are referring makes it criminal or make offer, receive, pay kickbacks in public health care programs within the state under state law so that it can be prosecuted, again, under state law if it is found to have occurred.
Chair Knorr.
So my question is that sufficient enough to address the challenge that we are faced with right now under this provision?
Deputy Tyson.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr. It addresses one problem, but not the problem that we have identified in this review. And the issue that we have identified is that DHS may not have ability to suspend or withhold payments on the basis of credible allegations of kickbacks during the course of an investigation.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're referring now to 256B.064. And quite frankly, the way I understand, because it's referencing the federal statute, which is 455.23, you don't have to have a proof. It's a more of a credible allegation. This does not mean that we're looking into fraud. So I think we need to define some of the other things. So under the same statute, because you don't have to have a proof, any complaint can be investigated. Mm-hmm. It's based on sanctions and monetary recovery. To my belief, that definition, that is referencing the federal law. is more than enough to really look into credible allegations, whistleblowers, and complaints. Anything that may be construed to be credible allegation, we're getting to credible allegation of fraud, not fraud itself. So is that not sufficient enough to trigger? Because I think the way I'm reading it, you don't have to have a proof. You don't need to have the intention, because once you move to fraud, then we are investigating the intentionality of that event.
Deputy Tyson.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, I want to kind of separate the administrative process from kind of the criminal sanction part of it, and I'm going to turn to our general counsel to explain in more detail.
Mr. Shepard, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your answer.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Nathan Shepard. I'm the Legislative Auditor's General Counsel. So specific to that question, so you're right that 256B.064 kind of has two pieces. One is allowing to impose sanctions at the conclusion of investigation. Those are the termination, the sort of permanent payment withholds. The ongoing issue that we're identifying is the suspension of payments during an investigation. And there are factors in the statute that determine when an allegation is credible. You know, they have to do a sort of a preliminary investigation to determine that it rises to that sort of burden of proof to be credible. The definition of fraud is fraud is defined in the administrative rule, and so that's where that definition comes from. There are requirements in federal law to have a program to do surveillance, integrity reviews, that kind of thing, including I think what you're referring to in 455.23, the CFR section. So there are requirements for that. The rules are a little different, and to my understanding, DHS doesn't enforce federal law. We had a little bit of a conversation in a hearing yesterday about that. They can't technically enforce the federal law, and so there has to be. It feels a little bit duplicative to have the same stuff in state law, but they would need to have some sort of authority under state law in order to enforce that during the administrative process. Does that get at what you're talking about?
Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I think it's complicated. When we're talking about Medicaid, we have to apply federal law where it's applicable, because we cannot put everything from federal statute into the state law. And so hence, to my belief, everything that we're doing, I'll give you a quick example. We're doing a prepayment review. Where is it in the statute that we have authorized that whole process when we're following the rules that are laid out by the federal government under the 455 or several other sections? And so hence, I think the applicability, because of that shared process between the federal and the state, has to be applied. So moving on, I think I wanted to focus on this specific issue. I know there's a reference to 256B.04 subdivision 2, which was the rulemaking. But if you look at subdivision 10, that gives the authority for investigation. These are the duties of the state agency. Why are we skipping things that are already in the statute? Because we will definitely clean up to have a clear guidance about what is abuse, what is fraud in the statute, in this session. I'm hoping if we can get things done. Is that not also sufficient enough to address some of these issues?
Mr. Shepard.
Sure. So, and there is authority in 256B.04 to both make rules and the duty to investigate. The process for investigation and the specific sort of the mechanics of doing the investigation, those sorts of things are set out kind of on top of the blanket sort of policy authority to do investigations and follow up on these issues. And so this is in that specific sort of mechanical, the procedural stuff that's in 256B.064. And there are rules in Chapter 9505 for DHS to do sort of even more detailed investigatory process. And that's where the fraud definition rule is. So you're right that there's authority to do investigations in 256B.04. And I think there's an obligation even for the commissioner to do that kind of thing and address fraud related issues. Part of the way that they do that is by following the specific sort of processes, mechanics that are in a separate statute.
Chair Knorr.
My final question, I think if you look also last year, we defined fraud under 15.013, I believe. Mm-hmm. That is more clear intent, but it's a more of a blanket. It's more of an enterprise-wide, and there's conversation ongoing on that discussion. How do we delineate between what is in Medicaid, what is in that section?
Mr. Shepard.
Sure. That's a great question. And we do, there's an appendix at the end of this report that talks about some of the changes that were enacted in 2025, including the authority in 15, I think it's 15.013 is the fraud payment withholding. There's a couple of ways that that's different. And we talk about that in the report, just the specifics of it. It's a little bit more limited, so you could only hold for 60 days, for Correct. Example. This is a sort of more specific Medicaid, it's a Medicaid-specific provision to withhold for the credible allegations of fraud. So the authorities differ slightly. And then my understanding is that that section of 15 sunsets next year, and I think there's discussion to extend that or alter that authority, and so that may address that as well. But just to look at, there is a discussion kind of those 2025 changes because there was a whole host of things, 609-542, the criminal statute, for example, the fraud withholding, payment withholding statute. So those were enacted. This is a pretty narrow slice of what we would recommend following up on following those changes.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you so much for mentioning that the temporary between the 60 days versus the unlimited process. So that's also additional conversation because if there is a credible allegation, there's need to refer the cases to the law enforcement, including Mufuku, within 24 hours. So that means the prosecution needs to start immediately. So hence, I think there's conversation about what is the temporary payment withhold to the extent that we're able to prosecute those who are committing fraud. So if we put things in perpetuity in terms of saying this is just a payment withhold, then we're not doing the work that is necessary to address the challenges that we're talking about in general because nobody will be prosecuted for a long time. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Any follow-up on that from either of you? Okay. Representative Hicks, you were gesticulating a little bit ago. Did you... Were you seeking?
Okay. I think Mr. Chair read on my net asked the question.
I was just going to say my bill puts all that federal rule in statute. Just
thank you, Representative Hicks. Any other questions for the Office of Legislative Auditor? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your time this morning and for your efforts on this and many other issues that we deal with in the state. Next, we have the Department of Human Services. Commissioner Gandhi can make her way forward. And members, our attempt today, the commissioner did put together a slide presentation for us in response to this report. We have had numerous hearings on the program as a whole and some of the pieces there, and so I'm hoping that we can confine our conversations today to what was in the legislative auditor report and the presentation that is given here so that we can really drill down into this issue as much as we can and keep that narrow focus today as we have. And Commissioner, I understand that you had to move a few things around to be with us this morning, so I appreciate that. I also understand that you are unable to be with us next week, in part because your daughter is getting married and you will be out of town for that. And just wanted to say congratulations, for one. And two, if you haven't picked out a Mother of the Bride's dress, I know a place in Laverne does a really nice job. Great prices. But now let's talk about kickbacks. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Shireen Gandhi, currently serving as the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I do have my Mother of the Bride dress.
Oh.
However, I'm sure there will be future opportunities for Yay. Me to need a dress, and always am happy to learn about new places to seek them out. Chair Schumacher, Chair Noor, Vice Chairs Gilman and Keeler, and committee members, I value our collaborative partnerships with chairs and legislators from both parties. I also want to thank the legislative auditor for the important work she and her team have done on the special review of the department's investigations. into alleged kickbacks in the early intensive developmental and behavioral health intervention, or EIDBI, program. DHS has done extensive work over the last year and a half to increase oversight of this essential service. And since we're in one of our committees of jurisdiction, I thought some of this general overview of what we're doing would be helpful in addition to our response to the OLA report. Since the fall of 2024, our staff have made 444 on-site visits to EIDBI providers. We've increased the risk level of EIDBI to high risk. We've paused new EIDBI businesses from enrolling in to bill for services. EIDBI providers are subject to our enhanced prepayment review process for the fee-for-service claims. We've worked with legislators last session, as was discussed earlier this morning, to pass provisional licensure and the path to full licensure. And we are revalidating all EIDBI businesses right now. We're right in the process of Minnesota Revalidate, and those will be completed by the end of May, including fingerprint background studies for owners and unannounced site visits. I won't spend too much time on this next slide, but wanted to make sure that this committee had some details about this ongoing work. In addition to the 444 site visits to providers, in 25 and 26, we have opened 63 investigations into EIDBI providers. We've referred 20 providers to law enforcement and imposed 22 administrative sanctions against providers, including monetary recovery, payment suspensions, and terminations. And with respect to the OLA findings, I was pleased to see that in the vast majority of cases, the OLA found that the Office of Inspector General properly investigated the fraud complaints and made appropriate decisions on whether to close them or refer them for additional investigation. In a narrow set of cases, there was an allegation of kickback and no other allegation of fraud. The department closed the three EIDBI cases over about an 8-year period. The report was from 2019 to 2024, I believe, is what the cases that were looked at. And the department has been pursuing changes to get kickback investigation and authority in state statutes since about 2019, and we accomplished that last year thanks to this committee and the partnership of many legislators. Still, we agree with the OLA that the definition of fraud should be made more clear to include kickbacks. We believe that this is the strongest path forward, and also the fastest path, is to put it into state statute. It's part of the governor's proposals this year, and appreciate, as was noted by the deputy legislative auditor, that many legislators have offered those bills as well. If the legislature does not act this session, we will move forward with rulemaking again, but our preference is to have it in state statute. Additionally, the department is re-reviewing all past kickback reports. Inspector General Clark is leading that effort, not just those related to EIDBI, to make sure that all were handled appropriately. I want to thank again the legislative auditor and her team for their work. We share the goal of ensuring taxpayer dollars are actually being used for the services that are making and supporting critical health of Minnesota's vulnerable Minnesotans. And I welcome any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation there. As we're collecting names for messages, names for questions. I'll just start with the question I had for the OLA on that. Of course, we understand that the original definition that was put in rules was in 1995. There's been five administrations since then. From your understanding of how the departments function, Is this something that gets done at more the civil servant level or the political level for this type of rulemaking and interpretation piece from that? And do these things get reviewed in the process overall for that? Could this have been found sometime in the last 30 years? Otherwise, is, I guess, how we'll start.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So generally, because DHS has thousands of lines of statute, many highly specialized areas of services that we provide, this is generally the experts or at the civil servant level. However, certainly one would expect that we would have found this over the past so many decades. It's unfortunate that we did not. It's unclear to me why we did not. And I know that our teams are passionate and dedicated, and I think the nonpartisan staff here at the legislature, you know, would agree that the teams work to clean up statute, to double check and make sure that everything is as solid as possible in statute. That is very important for us at DHS, especially in the area where we take action against providers or will end up being challenged in court. That's why it's really important for us to have as clear authority as possible, because when we are taking action, we want law enforcement's hard work to actually be recognized in courts, to not be dismissed, and to have the strongest, you know, penalties for the people that have committed wrongdoing.
Thank you, Commissioner. So in that process, that would also point to the idea that having this in statute versus just cleaning up in rule in 24 months' time would be the stronger way to go, especially in the court system. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's my opinion. I don't know if others disagree, but that's my opinion.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for being here today. A question about there was a moratorium on EIDBI that the legislature had passed in 2025, and it's my understanding that that took until November to be implemented. Can you kind of give us a picture of what that sort of six-month lag, what that entailed or why that happened or what caused that moratorium to take a while to roll out?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Curran, thank you for that question. We don't have Inspector General Clark here today. He's on vacation with his family, so he has may have a more detailed answer. I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Connolly does. But I know one of the things I know is that we need to, you know, prepare for the process, notify providers, and so usually there's a lag. But I don't know the specifics of that one. John, do you have more?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and help us with that question.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Representative Curran. I think the additional texture I'd add, though I'm sure Inspector General Clark has more, is again just making sure that with respect to any provider enrollment moratorium or licensing moratorium, there's sufficient access and just doing all the due diligence before we implement interventions like that so that people have access to the services they need. And of course, just reviewing all the different data with respect to investigations and concerns and trends with respect to claims or otherwise that we'd want to be assessing carefully and have a handle on before we make that decision.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. Yeah, I understand that processes can take a while to roll out. I think with a moratorium, there's a lot of different things going on. It seems like you can continue to do investigations separately from putting out a message that there's a moratorium. It's already in the public when the legislature passes it, right? And so I'm still struggling a little bit to figure out the 6 months. Like, was there an internal struggle over whether a moratorium should happen or how it should roll out? Because I know we've done moratoriums before, and there's been times where it comes down with no warning, and it's just today, and not even the legislature knows about it. So I'm having trouble sort of
comparing these different scenarios.
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair, Representative, that's a really good question. And I think one of the key things that we have to go through in some of the processes that I noted earlier is federal CMS approval for it. So that was, I think, one key step in the process. We had to, again, provide the information that I referred to earlier to them and seek their approval. There are requirements to demonstrate on the state side that we have sufficient access to care before we implement any sort of moratorium, either with licensing or enrollment.
Representative Curran. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Commissioner. From your understanding, and more specific, who at DHS made approval for the decision not to investigate these kickback allegations?
Turn this on. That would help. From your understanding, who within DHS made or approved this decision not to invest these kickback allegations that we heard about this morning?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, thank you for that question.
You can call me Backer, I'm okay.
Backer, Backer.
I just can't tell you address.
That decision would have been within the OIG back in that time frame from 2017 or 2019 to 2024, because the OIG leadership and legal advice at that time was that DHS did not have the authority in the narrow instances where there was kickback only to take action. That would have been, you know, with the investigation staff based on the belief of the council and the inspector general.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, a couple follow-ups. Thank you. And how long, so it seems like from that answer, that interpretation was in effect starting 2017 for a couple of years. So during that interpretation, how many complaints were declined because of that interpretation?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, we know the three fell into this time frame because of the OLA's report in the EIDBI services. What we are doing right now is Inspector General is leading a review to identify that situation that would have or may have arisen in any Medicaid service, and to make sure that we put fresh eyes on it and take action as appropriate if action was not taken.
Representative Backer.
Okay, so you were involved during part of DHS at that time. So in with compliance, if I remember correctly. So were you or any of the other commissioners or leadership aware of this limitation?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, I was not aware of this limitation, and I was not aware of this situation at the time I was Chief Compliance Officer. I do not know what the previous commissioners knew.
Representative Backer.
Should be. Thank you, Chair. Final question. So this is where, and I appreciate you answering the question directly. I'm not here to do a gotcha question. This is where the frustration happens. We're talking about taxpayers' dollars that are being used, which should have been used for services, and you're answering the question as best as you can, but it seems like there was lack of other choice words, a laissez-faire type of approach about this whole process. And this is where the constituents in my district and other parts of the state gets really frustrated, because as any of us who are responsible, if we own a ABC business, or like when I was on city council or school board, our goal was to have that check and balance. And it seems to me and to my constituents, there was not that check or balance. because it seems to me that would have been part of your responsibility or commissioner leadership. Because if there's kickback and there's fraud, it seems like, okay, that doesn't meet the definition, but we just keep sending the money out. How, you know, you can, people can come here and says it should have been inspected in statute. What people would say in my district is this seemed like to be common sense. Someone should have stopped it. This was not helping the constituents, and that's where the frustration is. So how do we get that common sense into leadership in DHS? That would be my question. That's the frustration I hear directly from my district and when I do different interviews.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, protecting the taxpayer dollars and having every single dollar go to the purpose that's intended is extremely important to me. And protecting the people who are supposed to be getting those services is extremely important to me. At DHS, over the past year plus, we have taken a significantly more proactive and aggressive posture, a less risk-averse posture. I think over the decades and because of pushback from providers, because of court cases, because of you know, other reasons, staff may have been more risk-averse. But we are taking a more aggressive posture, and one of the things that is very important to me, and I can only, you know, I can only control things as long as I'm in this position, but we are working very hard to put durable structural reforms into DHS that will last beyond an administration. That's part of what the corrective action plan with CMS includes. And that's part of what we have been working to do as we add, you know, all the checks and balances and the activities that we've been taking over the past year and a half. So I hope that leaves DHS better positioned to catch these things sooner and faster and address them.
Final comment. Yeah, thank you.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, and our constituents would, you know, when we see this amount of, I'll stay in this lane, this amount of fraud in this lane, we have to protect our taxpayers. And more importantly, protect people who deserve the services. And that's the frustration. It seemed like someone was driving the car in the back of the seat, back seat, instead of taking control of the wheel. So thank you.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Gandhi. One thing I'm not hearing today that I'm glad that I'm not hearing any denial. I'm not hearing any disagreement, right, with the report that came in. It's to say, correct. Yep, these things were uncovered. They were revealed. No attempt to hide or conceal. All that tells us is that improvements are being made and will be made. If there was denial, if there was, you know, a refusal to admit that, that errors were made, those errors would then be carried forward. We know that. So I greatly appreciate the fact that you've taken this and received it and said, yep, we're going to act on that, and we're going to keep on acting on it. It's a kind of an evolving process, I think. So I do have a question, though, and that question is, and you can neither confirm nor deny that we've had a culture that doesn't receive whistleblowers well, but that's the sense that we get, is that somehow whistleblowers were maybe pushed aside or even encouraged not to bring their information. So how do we alert anyone and everyone out there who could be listening that we welcome honest, credible revelation of fraud, waste, abuse? Put out the red carpet, invite it, do all that we can. For example, make sure they know, and I hope they can they stay anonymous? Or do they have to, you know, let their name be known? Is there a way to prosecute this criminally or however we do it in such a way that we preserve the privacy of whistleblowers? How do we put out the red carpet, the welcome mat, to say we want credible information of what's going wrong in implementing these programs? Thank you.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gander, thank you for that question. I'll start by saying that I have no doubt that people reported concerns and felt retaliated against. DHS in my time here has not had a lawsuit on it that has been, upheld. But as a compliance officer, I know when people report claims, they can perceive things that are not as retaliation, and they can perceive things that maybe not rise to a legal level of retaliation, but, feel it's look and sound like retaliation. So I know that people have felt that within DHS. I don't think it's widespread. I know that I also know people who have raised issues that have felt supported and welcomed. The entire time I've been at DHS, I have been working, especially when I was a chief compliance officer, and now as the commissioner continues to set the tone at the top, that any questions, any concerns that are raised are really gifts. They are gifts to the agency to catch a problem early. So our supervisors, our managers, it's natural as a human being to feel defensive when somebody says to somebody, hey, this is a problem in the work we're doing, right? If somebody owns that work, it's natural for them to feel defensive. The training and the work that we try to do with staff is to shift the mindset and see that as a welcome gift to solve a problem early and to look into it. It doesn't mean that what they're saying is right or wrong, but we have an obligation and a responsibility to look into it and then to close the loop to the degree that we're able to within law, depending on what was raised. I think it is very important. Our staff on the front lines are in the best place to know. It is helpful if they share that information with their name, because we need, oftentimes what is shared is not enough information for us to look into the issue fully, and we have to go back and forth with questions. However, I want the information no matter what. So if they need to share it anonymously, I think that's fine. If they want to share it not anonymously with the OLA, with legislators, with somebody else that can be the mediator and help us go back and forth with questions to get the information we need to fully investigate it, that is 100% okay too. They also have the avenue to report through the BCA, which has strong whistleblower protections.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a very full, complete answer. I appreciate it.
Representative Vernig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Gandhi. I have a question, or actually I have two questions. It doesn't describe what the kickbacks were, so maybe you can't go into that. But the question I do have is, were services actually provided to the youth in these cases?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Vernick. What I know at the time is that at the time, a couple of them had not billed us yet. So there was no billing in place at the time that the complaint came in. All I can say right now is that we are working with partners on oversight of those three.
Representative Vernig.
Thank you. My next question is, in your presentation, you said there's 22 EIDBI providers with administrative sanctions. How do you communicate that? Like, do you look to see, are these providers licensed in other areas? Do they have other programs? Do you look across that to ensure that we're looking at it more comprehensively, I guess, if that makes sense?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Vernig, yes. The Office of Inspector General, when we get a complaint, when we're investigating, looks at the looks across the various Medicaid services and determines whether there's appropriate action there as well. Generally, and again, Inspector General Clark would have more specific information, but generally, action is taken across the services. If that feels appropriate based on the nature of what we're finding.
Representative Vernig.
Thank you.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Commissioner Gandhi. So in the OLA report, it states DHS's administrative rules have for decades contained an error in the definition of fraud. While DHS could have acted at any time to revise its rules, it has permitted the error to stand since 1995, limiting its authority to address kickbacks. So my specific question then is, has DHS attempted to create a resolution through rulemaking to the kickback issue without legislation? And could you describe that to me?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacob. My understanding is that DHS has been pursuing a statutory path.
Representative Jacob.
So the answer is no, you have not pursued any resolution outside of legislative action?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacob, that's my understanding.
Representative Jacob.
So I guess another question then to me would be, if this problem has existed since 1995 through multiple administrations, why did it not rear its head until this administration at this time?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacob, my understanding is that staff was not aware of the mistake in the language. So that was brought to light by the OLA's review.
Representative Jacob.
Was not aware, or was it potentially exploiting the taxpayers and using this as the excuse? I mean, that's kind of what it, I mean, when I read the potential ways to resolve this, can you speak to that?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Jacob, I have seen absolutely no evidence that staff were intentionally using this. The Office of Inspector General is, you know, their role, their purpose is to protect taxpayer dollars and protect the people of Minnesota. You're asking me to go back, what is that, 30 years? I can't speak for 30 years of staff, but I trust the OLA and what they heard from our staff. And, you know, to the best of our knowledge, this was not known.
Representative Jacob.
Well, Chair Schumacher, thank you. The OLA report is not what's at issue here. What's at issue is your response to the report. So it clearly states that you had the authority since 1995 to address this through rulemaking, which you've stated you have not. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. One of the questions that comes to mind is when you were mentioning before about the providers that you had checked that had not billed to DHS, one of the things that comes to mind is that not all the billings go to DHS. Some of the billings go to the MCOs. So did anyone check to see if the MCOs had been billed for any of these services?
Yeah. Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Fisher, I would want to get back to you on that. I think generally when we say they haven't billed, it includes both MCOs and fee-for-service.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. I'd like to have clarification on that. If you could let us know, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. My question has to do with just red flags. You know, we talked a little bit about at the end of May when the, you know, we have all our enrollees are looking at having enrolled. And if there is a red flag that it looks like the trend is right now, we're having a smaller number. Do you have the legislation that you need to be able to look back at people to say, that's a red flag, I want to look into that, if people do not reapply, especially if it's a large number of people that don't reapply?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Murphy, I want to make sure I'm understanding the question. When you say people do not apply, are you speaking about providers becoming provisionally licensed?
Yeah. Representative Murphy.
Yes, provisional licenses. Thank you.
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Murphy, thank you for that question. Right now, we have more than 40 that have applied for provisional licensure. We have until May to find out how many will apply. I would like to double check with Inspector General Clark to see if we have everything we need, but in general, DHS, you know, has the ability with prepayment review and postpayment review that is underway for EIDBI providers to look carefully at any of the claims and pursue investigations and recoupments if needed. And so it would be a flag for me. I think it would be for anybody to have a service that was operating before licensure and choosing not to be licensed.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Commissioner. You know, my question, I want to target in a little bit further so that if the person is not a current provider but had been, but is not on the list, and that number is a really growing trend. We ramped up really fast, and I want to see if it ramps down really fast. And it doesn't matter if it's just this or if it's just with regard to kickbacks, but if we see that trend, do you have the legislation that you need to be able to look back at past providers to see if there's anything that we need to be asking them?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Murphy, I really appreciate that question, and I want to double check. I want to make sure, because it's a really good question. I think we do, but if we don't, I would like to share with you what we need.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. You know, catching kickbacks is the hard part. I think we need to show a message to people that we're always looking, and I think that will be a really good step in making sure that people feel really uncomfortable about doing anything that would be, you know, fraudulent. Thank you.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Just wanted to ask if you can just give us briefly what is the process of making rules under your authority?
Briefly, Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, yes, rulemaking is a, my understanding is rulemaking is a time-intensive process. We need to develop the rules, put it out for comment. You know, there's a lot of work that goes into that and time. It's a lengthy process. It is not always looked on favorably by legislators, as we heard this morning. And past practice and the practice of the state of Minnesota, as I understand it, with respect to the Department of Human Services, is that we work collaboratively with the legislators to put things in statute wherever possible.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that, I think rulemaking is supposed to be a temporary gap where we don't have legislation to get things organized and done by agencies. What we have done, you know, in the process is we've been adopting a lot of rules without incorporating those rules into the statute so that they have the authority as an ongoing. And I think that is something that is of a miss, because rulemaking is allowed, there are different processes, the comment period and everything else. So to the question is, instead of relying on the rulemaking, it's upon us to see what rules exist that we can codify into the law so that there's enough authority for the commissioner and the agencies to implement those rules. Something that I think we need to be looking ahead because many agencies are using rules to define things. Sometimes we may disagree with some of those rules. We want to have that opportunity to rectify and create guidelines, off-ramp, so that we can take care of that. So right now, we are being notified. I just wanted to make sure that people understand when they look back. As of today, I think we need to be looking forward how we codify some of those rules into the statute. The secondary portion that I wanted to comment about, if you look at the anti-kickback rules under the 42 CFR 101.952, there are certain kickbacks that are considered to be allowable under the federal rules. For example, if you wanted a practitioner to come to the rural areas, or specific exclusions exist under the law. I think the definition that we even have right now from the governor's recommendation, it does not include those exclusions. So what I'm afraid of, we may put a broad brush whereby now we are conflicting with what is already in the federal rules. How are we going to be able to solve that issue? Is there a plan to make sure that we look into the exclusions that are already listed under the federal rule that makes it permissible to give back any value so that we can be able to be in compliance?
Commissioner Gandhi.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, thank you for that question. It's a good one that you raise, and I don't have an answer off the top of my head, but of course what we would want to do is to make sure that the whatever we pass with the legislature for the statute and who the statute applies to, that what's included and excluded makes sense. So we can take that back, and perhaps you've already started having discussions when you talk about that specific legislation.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, indeed. We've started looking into so that we don't have this conversation again, what was included, what was not included. So we want to be able to capture everything. And I know, Commissioner, you said if we take the actions to codify into the statute, I want to make sure that it's clear. We will do that. It's when. So I'm hoping that my colleagues that it's about when, not if. If we keep it saying if, we will be back here saying what happened at the agency, what happened to this, what happened to that. We do have that obligation now to take care of our business, and hopefully we can be able to get legislation done in the next few weeks. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Agreed, Chair Knorr. Final word from the department, if you have one.
Chair Schumacher, thank you. Chair Knorr, thank you, members of the committee. I just want to continue to thank you for your partnership. I think the questions you raise are good. The insights you raise are good. And I will say what I really believe and say repeatedly, and that is to have a strong human services system. We need everybody working together. We need the Democrats. We need Republicans. We need the agencies. We need counties, managed care organizations, tribal nations, all of us to work together to make a strong human services system. So I appreciate the information on where you think we're doing well and where we need to improve. And I just look forward to the continued partnership.
Thank you for that. And the committee thanks you for your time this morning and helping us through this issue. With that, we get to be back here at 8:15 tomorrow morning. See you then.